This is File 16, Cycle 3. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is December 14th, 2017. I am interviewing Dr. Jack Bowman, who is the director or minister of music at the Salisbury Congregational Church. He's going to talk about his family background, particularly the horse naming story, his career path, and how he came to the Salisbury Congregational Church, and anything else he wants to throw in for interest. But first, we'll start with the genealogical information.
My parents were both from families of farmers and families of teachers.
Okay, and your name is?
My name is Jack Bowman.
And you are a Jack, not a John.
That's correct.
And your birth date?
They figured if they gave me a nickname, I wouldn't have to worry about...
That's true.
...having it messed up. So, my name is Jack.
And your birth date?
It's February 27, 1945.
And you were born where?
I was born in Youngstown, Ohio. My parents lived outside of Youngstown in a little small coal mining town. And there were, of course, no hospitals, so...
You were born at home?
No, they drove me into Youngstown to the hospital on the south side of town. And I was born there at an early age.
Your parents' names?
Dale and Elizabeth.
And what was...
But Elizabeth was never known as Elizabeth. She was always known as Betty.
And her maiden name was Clark. Without an E.
Without an E, yes.
Now, before I ask you about your siblings, I want the horse naming story, please.
Well, I have to give a little sibling story before the horses.
Okay.
Because I have a sister, Jane Susan, and my brother's named Jim. But after my father died, I inherited a picture of my father with his three horses from the farm. And I knew that he had grown up on the farm, and I knew he had horses, but I really hadn't seen this picture. And I had never held it and never looked at the back of it. And the back of it says, Dale with his three horses, Betty, Jane, and Susan. And, of course, my mother's name was Elizabeth, but he never called her Elizabeth. She had to be Betty. And my sister was named Jane Susan. So the women in my life were all named by my father after his horses, which I never knew until I...
Well, it's a good thing he didn't have five horses named Jim and Jack.
Yes, well, anyway, I always thought that was interesting and amusing.
Oh.
And the funny thing is, at some point in life, he decided to buy the tombstone for their grave, and he put Dale and Betty. And my mother just came unglued. She said, no, you're going to redo that tombstone. I am not going to have a tombstone that says Betty. My name is Elizabeth.
Good for her.
My mother stood up to him.
Now, tell me about your early musical training, and I think it may have started with you wanted to play the trumpet.
I did. Fourth grade, the band director came around the school and said, who wants to be in the band? And I said, I do. I want to play trumpet. And he said, well, you don't really have the dental structure for playing a trumpet. You should play something else. And I went home, and my parents, with modest means, said, Uncle Ralph has a metal clarinet in the attic that you could use. So I started on... somewhat reluctantly, on Uncle Ralph's metal clarinet, which I still have today. But the band director put all of the old metal clarinets players in the back row so that they wouldn't be seen. And the students with the new flashy black plastic clarinets all got the front seats. So I got a newspaper route and saved my money, and I bought a new clarinet, and I went from last chair to first chair and decided that the view is much better from the lead puppy.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the way you maintain your musical career for the rest of your life. You like to be in the front seat.
I guess that's true.
Tell me about your musical training, college and so forth. Where did you go to college?
And I went to Ohio Wesleyan.
Okay.
And I studied church music, organ, and clarinet. And I played in the band, I played in the orchestra, I sang in the choir. So I got a really a good education with a lot of performance opportunities. And it was a small school, so everybody gets to do a lot of things.
And that's good.
And then for my master's, I went to the University of Michigan and did a master's in woodwind performance, which is unique.
Yes, it is.
I had to play clarinet, flute, oboe, sax, bassoon.
All of them?
All five of them, yes.
Is the technique different?
Everyone's got a different fingering system, and some of them use reeds and some of them don't.
Yeah, I knew that. All right.
But I studied with good teachers, and so then I got my first teaching job at Alma College, and while I was doing that, I finished my doctorate. And I did my doctorate in music performance, so I had woodwind clarinet parts to it as well as organ. So my dissertation was actually on the Bach organ fugues.
Ooh!
Which, long ways from starting on a clarinet.
Oh, what an extensive musical background.
So.
How wonderful.
But most of my career has been in higher education. I've always taught in a university. And after about 10 years from then on, I was an administrator. So
You were at the University of...
I was in Oklahoma, Illinois, most recently the University of Minnesota, and I was dean of the School of Fine Arts, which presented me wonderful challenges with art, music, theater, dance, an outreach program, and a historic mansion, which was a learning experience.
I'll bet. Tell me about that one.
Excuse me. Early 1900s, Chester Congdon was a lawyer and built an estate in Duluth, Minnesota, right on Lake Superior, that he called Glensheen, named after the glen, the woods, and the sheen on the water, so Glensheen. And it was a 38-room, Jacobean-style, historic mansion with all the original furnishings and draperies and furniture and carpeting, oriental carpets, gold-plated ceilings. I mean, it was absolutely...
Oh,
he was the richest man in Minnesota at that point, and he build a house to show that. And when his family was all, no one member of the family could take care of the house, so
yep.
They gave the house to the University of Minnesota to be saved and maintained as a historic estate.
Mm-hmm.
So part of my joy as a dean of fine arts was to be involved with the mansion, and so we did a lot of historic restoration and preservation, and it was open to the public, so we had 100,000 visitors coming through there every year.
Wow.
We had big gardens, and we turned those gardens into actually working gardens and produced food that we gave to the food shelters. So.
Did you use the house for performances at all?
Yes, we did. They nearly killed me. We did operas in the house.
Oh, good.
So, for instance, we did The Marriage of Figaro.
Yeah.
And we did the first act in the living room with the orchestra on the stage, on the porch beside it.
Mm-hmm.
We did the second act in the basement. We did the third act out in the carriage house. And we did the fourth act on the back patio. And what a magnificent evening.
Oh, wow.
Yes, we did several performances, and they were always sold out.
Oh, sure.
And
just to see the house.
Just to see the house, but you know, it's a beautiful setting.
The logistics are daunting.
It was a challenge because you have the preservationists who thought you dare not move this piece of furniture.
I know.
Versus the others who said, "Come on, this is a house that the Congdons wanted this used." Mm-hmm. And so trying to balance those two was always somewhat of a challenge. But
I imagine you rose to the challenge admirably.
Well, we did several operas there.
Yep.
We had a big summer festival. We had performances on the back patio and people sitting out in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great fun.
Oh, yeah. So, and the ambiance would be fabulous.
We got the lake and the moon and all of that in the background. And so, anyway, let's move on from Glen Sheen.
Okay, how about talking about how you wound up in Turkey?
I was at the University of Minnesota for, I think, 14 years. And the president of the University of Minnesota changed. The president retired. And the new president elected to have all new deans. So there were 25, 30 of us that were all of a sudden looking for work. And I had, a year or two before, I had been in Istanbul on a number of projects that we were doing. And when I was in this one school, the rector, or as we would call him, president, pulled me aside and said, "You know, I want to hire you to come and work for me, and I want you to start a music conservatory." And I said, "Well, that sounds like a whole lot of fun. Let me get back to you." And I started sending him regular proposals, and we talked about how to do this. Mm-hmm. And so when things changed at the University of Minnesota, I called this guy and said, "Do you still want me?" He said, "I'll send you a contract today."
Wonderful.
So I went to Istanbul for 3 years, and I was hired to start a Western-style music conservatory. The only thing that we didn't do was start a Western-style music conservatory. The Turkish have great ambitions and great ideas and energy, but they have trouble sometimes following through on what they want to do.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So anyway, I took that as an opportunity to just enjoy myself. Mm-hmm. And I taught 4 days a week, and then Thursday night after work or Friday morning, I'd fly somewhere and spend a weekend. And everything's close. I went to Kiev several times, and Rome, and Paris, and all over Turkey, and Berlin. I just enjoyed my 3 years there.
Wow. Are you a linguist as well?
Well, I speak French, a little German, some Turkish.
Then you could manage.
So I got along fine.
Sure.
Okay. So, yes, when I'm in France, I speak French. I don't speak really any Italian, but my Italian friends all speak French. So
you're good to go on that one.
We're good to go there. But for the most part, everybody there speaks English.
Yeah, but it's nice.
Oh, it's nice if you have some language.
Yeah.
They have a much higher respect for you.
Mm.
The Paris people say the Paris people are snobbish. No, they're not.
No.
They're like us. They'd like you to know something about their language.
Mm-hmm.
So you speak a little French and stumble along, and then they become your friends. And
oh, yeah.
The French are wonderful people.
When I was traveling in Europe, I could say, you know, "Please, thank you, we're at the ladies' room," you know, stuff like that. But they would respond because I was at least attempting to speak their language. And I always got a big smile.
Yep.
Always got a big smile. And that's important. That's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did you pick Salisbury from Istanbul?
I knew it was time to leave because we weren't doing what I was told we were going to do. Mm-hmm. And also, it was becoming less safe over there, mm-hmm. terrorist situation. And the big war in Syria is having terrible effects on Turkey. So I started looking for a way to come back. And I knew that it would be relatively impossible to go back into higher ed. you don't start in higher ed at my age, but I've had church jobs, church music jobs, mm-hmm. for 50 years, and so I thought this would be a great opportunity to come back and spend my time developing a music program, mm-hmm. and so I applied for church music jobs all over the country, and I interviewed three or four places, and the best deal was Salisbury, Connecticut.
Oh, good.
So, and I interviewed in a big church in New York and mm-hmm. some other places. I interviewed for a Hartford job. And Salisbury is a wonderful place.
Oh, yes.
Great people. There's a mix here of those that want to keep Salisbury small and focused, kind of small.
Yep.
And there are those that want it to grow and to be dynamic and have influences from outside and bring the world here.
You can balance it.
So my challenge is to kind of balance the two worlds.
And so far you're doing a wonderful
job. That's what I'm trying to do here is to...
What year did you actually come?
2015.
Okay.
March 1, 2015. So I'm two and a half months shy of my third anniversary.
Wonderful. Did you use Al Sly as a mentor at all?
Oh, of course. Al became a very good friend when I got here, and one of the first people I went to lunch with, and then he brought together people that he thought I should know, and we had lunch with them. I'd go to his house, we'd have a sandwich, we'd talk, we'd go to a restaurant and talk. He never interfered in what I was doing, but he was always there to help and had good suggestions if I asked for them.
And he was so pleased that you came. I was his neighbor.
Oh.
And he would come over for dinner with me, and he'd say, oh, he says, I'm so pleased with Jack Bowman. He's doing wonderful things. And I'm not a member of the church, so he was telling me just because he was so pleased with you. What are some of the programs that you've either added or changed in the musical line?
I've tried to develop the choir so that it would include people who love to sing but can't always make a Wednesday night or always make a Sunday morning. Church choirs, historically, you came Wednesday night to rehearsal, and then you came Sunday morning, and you didn't sing Sunday morning if you couldn't make Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's really not the world we're living in now, you know? If your grandchild has a school performance on Wednesday night, you go see your grandchild. That doesn't, in my book, that doesn't preclude your singing on Sunday morning, because I rehearse the music in advance, so... We prepare this anthem for this week, but then the next week and the next week. So if you come to rehearsal, you've sung the anthems for the next 4 weeks or more. And so if you have to miss that certain rehearsal, you
can still
come
know
on Sunday and you still have a pretty good idea what you're doing. So I've tried to be more flexible and open in terms of receiving people that want to also have a life outside the church.
Yeah.
We've started the Sinfonietta, the mm-hmm. Salisbury Sinfonietta, which is a professional chamber orchestra. And that has tremendous opportunities to enhance the church program.
Oh, yes.
Because we do our oratorios with orchestra as they were written, rather than with an organ accompaniment. And there's a whole lot of difference between doing the Messiah with strings versus doing it with organ. And so we've done major works since I've been here. We've done the Easter section of the Messiah. We've done the Saint-Saëns Christmas Oratorio, the Rudder Christmas Oratorio, the Dave Brubeck La Fiesta de la Posada.
Which was excellent.
Thank you. In the spring, we did Messiah 1 year, and the next year we did... something else.
That's okay.
So I'm trying to include repertoire that am trying to perform the repertoire as close to the original as I can. So if that includes orchestra, we use orchestra.
Mm-hmm. How many in the Sinfonietta?
Well, we hire the players for the concert. So there can be a concert with three players, wow, and there can be a concert with 40 players. So, when we did the concert in Hartford, I think we used close to 40. Mm-hmm. But then here we've never exceeded about 30 because that's really the capacity of what we have space for.
Yeah, yeah. Now, does the Al Sly Music Fund help fund any of this?
No.
No.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
The Sinfonietta is funded separately. It has its own fundraising, has its own bank account, its own 501c3. Gifts that are made to the mm-hmm. Sinfonietta are mm-hmm. tax deductible. So if the church is doing a cantata or an oratorio, the church hires the Sinfonietta and pays for them okay. out of church funds, such as the Al Sly Fund. But if the Sinfonietta does a concert that it is sponsoring, it has to raise its own money.
I see. Okay. What else does the Al Sly Music Fund cover?
Well, there are other concerts than just orchestra.
Okay.
We had this year, we had an organ recital with a clarinetist from Italy and an organist from Iowa. We had the Reformation Unity Celebration in Hartford, where we had 30 churches from around the state and their choirs singing. We had an Asian immigration story with artists from California telling an Asian immigration story. We have just had the Brubeck La Fiesta, which had 90 participants,
wow,
including our choir, children from Salisbury Church, children from Norfolk Church and Norfolk School,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
the Norfolk Choir, Chorus Angelicus Junior Choir, the Sinfonietta, which required 13 musicians, and it was a mariachi band.
Yes, it was wonderful.
And the soloists were graduates of Western Connecticut, and then they all have master's degrees from beyond that, Louisiana, Yale, etc.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then Jennifer Tayo, our own local soprano, sang the role of Mary.
Beautiful voice.
So, and then this spring, the Al Sly Fund is helping bring back Dunya, which is a Turkish ensemble from Boston. And we'll again have a dialogue about Muslim neighbors. We still do the open recital for area music students.
Oh, good.
And the Al Sly Fund pays for that. And then our big program this spring is the Haydn Creation. And we're doing the entire creation with orchestra. And joining us is the Norfolk Choir, as well as the Chœur d'Oratorio de Limour. It's a Paris, France semi-professional choir. There are
oh my.
60 members of the choir, and this came about because I was talking to the director of the Paris Sinfonietta, and being the Salisbury Sinfonietta, we were talking, and I said, "What are you doing this spring?" And Dominique said, "Well, we're doing the Haydn Creation." And I said, "Well, so are we. Why don't you bring your people to sing with us?" And he said, "Well, I'll ask them." And so they went to the choir mm-hmm. and said, "You know, how many of you would like to pay your own way and go to Salisbury, Connecticut, and sing the creation over there?" And initially there were 20 that said they would do that. And then it got up to 30, and then it got to 40, and now it's at 50.
Wow.
So we have 50 really fine singers coming from Paris, France, to sing in the Haydn Creation.
And you're doing it at the Congregational Church?
Right here, yes.
How are you going to fit them all in?
Put them in the balcony.
Well, that's no fun, then. You can't see them.
Well,
okay.
You sit in the right place, you can.
Yeah, well, All right. Now, and as a reverse, you'll be going to Paris with...
And anybody that's singing here is welcome to go sing in Paris.
Ah. And I think you told me that you were dividing it up as far as language was concerned?
Yes, it turns out that we had all of these details pretty much worked out, and then the director said to me, quote, "By the way, we sing this in German," end quote. And I said, "By the way, we sing this in English," end quote. And so we decided that our solution would be that we'll sing, there are eight choruses, mm-hmm. and we'll sing 1, 3, 5, and 7 in English, and 2, 4, 6, and 8 in German. So our people get the experience of learning the German, and they get to learn their English.
And it's not too onerous.
No, it's not hard to learn four choruses in German.
No, it isn't. It isn't.
No.
Oh, my word.
So anyway, I think that'll be an incredible opportunity. And then we're going to take the performance down to New York, to a church in New York City. And those that want to go sing there can go sing.
Oh, my word. You have big plans.
So, it's a we can do great things here in Salisbury, Connecticut.
Well, you've done great things already.
We just try to keep that up.
Yes, yes. Would you like to add anything else to the interview before
we close?
No,
I think your project is really so important, and thank you for doing that, and I appreciate your time and interest in what I'm doing.
Oh, I'm very happy to be able to interview you, and thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.